Good day, and welcome to the CHA member briefing. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your telephone keypad. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. Please note this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to Carmela Coyle. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, operator, and thanks to all of you for taking time out of your busy days to join us for this very important member briefing. We've got over 100 people on the line today, which gives you some sense of the order of magnitude of today's topic. What we're going to do today is to give you a thorough briefing on what is a very complex set of issues, and that is the Medicaid Fiscal Accountability proposed rule, recently proposed at the federal level. Just a few points of summary before we dig into the detail, and then I'll make some introductions of today's team. First of all, this is complicated. We're going to try to be gentle today, and that is make certain that we take you through enough of the detail that you can understand it, but please know that you can reach out to any of the members of our team on the presentation today in follow-up if you've got additional questions, even after the conclusion of this call. Second, I want to remind everybody that this is a proposed rule. That means there is still more process to come, a comment period, an opportunity for the federal government to decide this is either a good idea or a bad idea, and then a final rule after that. We will be actively engaged throughout that. You'll hear more about that on this call. I then want to flag for you the reason that we're doing this call in particular is that this proposed rule has a significant potential impact. And it's a potential impact not just on the state of California, but a reminder that this has an impact across 50 states. You'll be hearing more about that. So on the one hand, of course, we want to make certain that we are well positioned to protect a number of important ways that we have financed our Medi-Cal program over the years, but we are not alone and we'll be joined by 49 other states and the District of Columbia in battling what is a pretty darn bad proposed rule. And final observation, this isn't our first rodeo. That is, there have been attacks in both Republican and Democratic presidential administrations in the past on the way in which Medicaid is financed across 50 states. So it's not our first time through, but that does not mean, even though we've been successful in beating this back in the past, that we are not vigilant and on top of it. At the close of the call today, you'll hear more about our advocacy strategy. So with that, let me introduce the team of folks that you've got with you on the phone today who will be either presenting or available to answer questions. First up is going to be Ryan Witz. Ryan is our Vice President for Healthcare Finance Initiatives. He's really going to walk us through more of the content of the proposed rule to make certain that we've all got the same base set of information. He'll be followed by Alyssa Keefe, our Vice President for Federal Regulatory Affairs. Alyssa is point on our comment development and filing process. She'll be talking about the structure of those comments and the important ways in which you can help. And closing out with Ann O'Rourke, our Senior Vice President for Federal Relations. Ann will be sharing with you our advocacy strategy at this point, and I want to underscore that we are working collaboratively. You'll hear more from Ann on this, but that strategy could shift as need be. This will be a multi-stage level of activity. In addition, we've got on the line to answer any potential questions, Kat Scott, who is our Senior Vice President for State Advocacy Issues and Affairs. There is, of course, a direct state connection, and we're happy to answer any questions there. And finally, we've got our colleagues from Hooper Lundy Bookman, that is both Lloyd Bookman and Paul Garcia. They are very much a part of our team as we pull this one apart. So with that by way of introduction, let me please turn the call over first to Ryan Witz, and he's going to take us starting with a wade and then go in deep. Thank you very much, Ryan. Turning the call over to you.
Thank you, Carmela. Good morning, everyone. Over the next 45 minutes, we're going to touch on the significant provisions within the Medicaid Fiscal Accountability proposed rule and the specific impacts to California. We'll discuss our overall strategy on comments and next steps within the advocacy strategy. Lastly, we'll finish up with an opportunity to ask questions. As a reminder, you can ask your question online at any time in the Adobe Connect room, and we'll address those questions at the end of the presentation. So let's get started. This proposed rule is finalized, if finalized, will impact every single state Medicaid program around the country. As Carmela had mentioned, it's not a red state, blue state issue. It's a national issue. The proposed rule is a product of over 10 years of growing scrutiny into how Medicaid is financed. In February of 2008, CMS published the Medicaid program healthcare-related taxes final rule, which later delayed by Congress and eventually was rescinded under the Obama administration. Over the last 10 years, both the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, and the Office of Inspector General, OIG, have issued reports criticizing the distribution of supplemental payments and CMS's lack of oversight. As such, pressure continues to mount on CMS to make changes. Additionally, in 2016, CMS required California to change the methodology for how it calculated the MCO tax. Previously, the structure reflected only a sales tax on Medicaid premiums, and as you may recall, Governor Brown ordered a special session to address this shortfall in his budget. The end result was SBX 22, which implemented a new enrollment-based tax that pressed the boundaries of how the provider tax regulations were authorized. And I know this because I worked with the Medicaid director at the time when we were designing it. During the review and approval process, CMS shared with the state that they were not pleased with the structure and the design in particular, and would seek to make future regulatory changes to address it. So we've known that this is, from the Medicaid perspective, has been coming for some time. But in the preamble of the proposed rule, CMS states it's their intent to clarify and finalize existing policy or guidance. While we believe some of the proposed rule does codify existing guidance, the vast majority is considered new policy or a significant increase in CMS's discretion that is of great concern to us and many states around the country. So let's just level set. Here's an overview of the notice of proposed rulemaking that was issued by CMS on November 18th, with an original comment deadline of 60 days due back on January 17th of 2020. Over the holiday break, CMS extended the comment period for another 14 days to February 1st. As we'll speak to in a little bit, we encourage each and every one of you to formally submit comments recommended by Friday, January 31st. As a reminder, this is a proposed rule. It is not a final rule. CMS must consider comments and issue a final rule before any policy discussed today can be effective and action can be taken. Further, CMS is under no statutory timeline to finalize this regulation. While we believe they are politically motivated to do so in advance of the next election, there is no requirement for them to do so. So adding on to the level setting, really the first bullet here is an important one. As you know, the Medicaid program is a federal-state partnership. Both share in the cost of providing services. And as it was originally intended, because not all states have the same resources to allocate toward their Medicaid programs, states have been granted considerable flexibility with designing their programs. That flexibility extends to the various sources of funding that states use for the non-federal share of their program. This proposed rule targets four specific areas with a heavy emphasis on the state's ability to finance the Medicaid program. Over the next few slides, we'll touch on three of the more significant provisions within the rule and where we intend to focus our comments. So for the first significant provision, CMS in their proposed rule is clearly targeting healthcare-related taxes, or also known as provider taxes. Today, the rules are clear. Taxes must be broad-based, imposed uniformly, and cannot guarantee providers are held harmless. And states have the ability to seek a waiver of the broad-based and uniformity requirements by demonstrating through a statistical test that the tax is generally redistributive. California has done so. They have five provider taxes, and most require seeking this type of waiver, and this has been the case with every single hospital fee program to date. The proposed rule. So in the proposed rule, CMS has expanded upon the waiver requirements for broad-based and uniformity. In order to receive federal approval of future provider tax waivers, states must demonstrate to CMS the tax does not impose an undue burden on Medicaid services. Now, this table in front of you illustrates the current proposed hospital fee program under review at CMS. This specifically is the state fiscal year 19-20 taxing rates. And as you can see, not all tax rates are equal, aka they're not uniform. And most importantly, the tax is structured to tax Medicaid utilization higher than all other days. If the rule were finalized today, the current program under review at CMS would not pass this undue burden test. Now, several of you have reached out asking about the limitations set forth in state law to make changes, specifically Proposition 52, which locked in the existing structure. Now, while state law does include a requirement to maintain the historical proportions of taxing tiers, which is what we've done above, there is a provision in state law that allows the department the discretion to make changes in order to meet federal requirements. So if this rule were to become final, the department would be required to make structural changes to the hospital fee program to meet this undue burden test. We don't believe that this would have an impact on the overall net benefit of the program, right? The same amount of payments will be going out, the same amount of taxes will be raised. However, we anticipate there would be a direct impact on the distribution of the net benefit. Now, this last bullet here with the green thumbs up makes reference to CMS including a grandfather clause in the proposed rule. If the state can get approval of the proposed tax under review at CMS right now, before this rule becomes final, any changes as a result of the proposed rule would not take effect until January 2022. In the proposed rule, CMS continues to propose changes to the structure, the provider tax structures, specifically targeting those that have separate private grant programs used to mitigate the impact on taxpayers. CMS is adding a new net effect standard that will take into consideration any arrangements that may result in a return of all or any portion of the tax. It is not clear from the proposed rule exactly how CMS plans on operationalizing this provision, but the preamble is clear of their intent. Our initial read of this provision is that it is problematic for our CHFT program, but we're currently working with Hooper Lenny Bookman to review this portion of the rule very closely. As it stands currently, we believe it is in our best interest to remain silent on this issue and do not plan to submit comments on this provision. As proposed, CMS would also consider the totality of circumstances when reviewing provider taxes on a case-by-case basis. This proposal provides additional agency discretion that we believe is unworkable. Even if states were able to make changes to pass CMS's more restrictive requirements, CMS also proposes a subjective test which could consider why the tax program is designed the way it is and to determine if it involves any groupings of taxpayers that could place a higher burden on Medicaid activity, whether directly or indirectly. This additional discretion is a huge issue for all Medicaid agencies, including a catch-all standard that is subjective, will not provide states with enough guidance to comply with the new requirements. Additional changes noted here on this slide, CMS is proposing to limit taxes to no longer than 3 years. And while this is not an issue for the hospital fee program due to the limitation in state law, it would be problematic for other provider taxes in California. For example, the proposed MCO tax is currently 3.5 years. CMS is also proposing to expand what it views as a taxable class to include health insurers. We have this marked as a question mark on this slide because it's an area of concern for us, but we're unclear as to the specific impact on California. And then lastly, CMS is increasing the pressure and responsibility on states to oversee the programs during the approved tax waiver period. As many of you have noted in your read of the proposed rule, it is very complex, and there are places in the rule that are entirely unclear as to the agency's intent. So jumping to the second significant provision of the rule, CMS is proposing to make significant revisions for how states use other funding sources for the non-federal share. Today, federal statute provides states with flexibility to utilize up to 60% of the non-federal share for the program with local funding, that is local taxes, intergovernmental transfers, certified public expenditures, etc., or as later clarified in 1991, provider taxes and provider donations. As many of you know, California must appropriate state funds to account for a minimum of 40% of the state's non-federal share. There is current regulatory framework for using public funds, so up to the 60% of the non-federal share. This existing framework specifies what is viewed as an allowable public source. And just so long as the public funds are not considered recycled federal funds, public funds can be appropriated by the state, transferred by other public agencies, or certified by other public agencies. Today, this flexibility gives designated public hospitals, district hospitals, and other public providers the ability to intergovernmental transfer to the state and receive enhanced reimbursement. Without these flexibilities, it can mean the difference between staying open and closing for many of these hospitals. So the proposed rule replaces the public funds flexibility with more limiting language that will significantly restrict public providers' ability to utilize intergovernmental transfers and certified public expenditures, moving forward creating a significant gap in funding needed for the non-federal share of the program. CMS also includes a limitation that will require only state general fund appropriations by the legislature to be allowable, so that's in B1. Now for California, this may create a significant issue for the use of special funds in our Medi-Cal program. Today, Medi-Cal uses over hundreds, I don't know how many to be exact, but hundreds of special funds to support the program. Proposition 56, the tobacco tax revenue, is just one of them. Second, CMS is limiting intergovernmental transfers to funds only derived from state or local taxes. This removes the flexibility that exists today and will considerably limit availability of funding to use moving forward. Now, in 2005, DHCS did receive written guidance from CMS that gave California the ability to use public funds as currently defined. Thereby, this proposed change runs contrary to longstanding CMS policy for California, which is just another example that CMS is not implementing existing policy guidance, rather making very significant and problematic changes. Third, CMS proposes a new section to further limit the availability of states to utilize certified public expenditures, and we go into depth on the next slide. So with regard to limiting the availability of certified public expenditures, CMS is proposing new, more restrictive standards for determining reasonable costs. They are also proposing a new requirement that the certifying entity, county in many examples, must retain the federal funds. We have this retention requirement flagged as an issue for our public providers. Lastly, CMS is requiring that reconciliations of certified public expenditures must be completed within 24 months. This arbitrary limitation will be a major issue for California, as there's never been a reconciliation completed within 2 years. Most generally take 4 to 5 years, as is the experience with our county behavioral health providers. So another significant provision that we wanted to highlight today, federal law provides flexibility to Medicaid agencies for developing payment rates and methodologies for Medicaid services. As long as they are viewed as efficient and economical, CMS typically doesn't have a problem with approving a state's request. The determination of that efficient and economical standard is achieved by states demonstrating an upper payment limit. And really, this last set of significant provisions within this proposed rule are associated with changes to fee-for-service supplemental payments. And even though, as we've discussed so far in the first two significant changes, the proposed rule will impact the foundation of Medicaid financing, which will impact the entire program. The proposed changes in this section are really focused on state plan amendments which implement the fee-for-service supplemental payments. As you all know, the Medicaid managed care supplemental payments are subject to different requirements and processes. For example, the demonstration of reasonableness is through actuarial soundness, and separately, additional network provider requirements are associated with supplemental payments or directed payments. But the proposed rule, there's really a lot to this slide, but the top line message here is that the proposed rule will considerably expand CMS's discretion in approving supplemental payments. Today, states are providing most of the first three items listed on this slide. For the second bullet, eligibility criteria regarding supplemental payments, this is a criteria that is generally included in all state plan amendments submitted to CMS. However, in the proposed rule, CMS has proposed to redefine the existing three UPL ownership categories to reflect state government provider, non-state government provider, and private provider. It's currently unknown whether any providers would flip from a public to private status as a result of these changes, but we're tracking this as a possible risk. For the third bullet, including a methodology, again, is common practice today. However, including it at a provider level as proposed is not. If CMS begins analyzing every supplemental payment program at a provider level, both from a payment perspective and an upper payment limit perspective, we could have issues with several existing distribution methodologies included in existing supplemental payment programs today. For the fourth bullet, limiting state plan amendments and supplemental payments to a three-year approval, even though most state plan amendments in California are approved annually, we believe this change will create significant workload concerns for both CMS and DHCS. It's important to note in the proposed rule, CMS has also failed to space out the effective dates for this provision, which means if the rule were to be finalized, all Medicaid SPAs or state plan amendments could be renewed around the same time. And so we definitely intend to flag this in our comment letter as an unnecessary administrative burden and that it will create risks with delayed approvals. For the fifth bullet, Medicaid programs do this today, but on an informal basis, monitoring the plan, monitoring to ensure the program remains in compliance. But if the state is implementing a monitoring plan that adds risk to reopening approved tax waivers or supplemental payments mid-program, then this could create an issue for hospitals and their ability to have confidence in their financial planning. The last bullet really speaks to the evaluation requirement. that would be required prior to the renewal of any subsequent state plan amendments. We believe this will have significant risks with creating additional needs and delays with CMS approval. It's a requirement on the Medicaid managed care side with direct-to-payments today, and we have seen delays and approvals as a result. So as a result of these six core requirements, we're concerned this will provide CMS with significant discretion during their review and approval of future supplemental payments. Additionally, CMS is proposing to standardize the upper payment limit demonstrations, and the first item here indicated on the slide is really focusing on data sources. On this second slide here, CMS is focusing on standardizing the upper payment limit methodologies. And now, while most of these changes are based on existing guidance, CMS is also proposing to apply uniformity for upper payment limit demonstrations within the provider category. So no longer will they accept different methodologies for public versus private providers. This would be a change from existing practice today. And collectively, these upper payment limit changes add pressure to the overall upper payment limit room, which will decrease the state's flexibility to maximize the fee-for-service supplemental payments moving forward. Now, there are various other concerns within the proposed rule that we're not highlighting today, but one that we did include here on this slide is a focus on CMS's decision to impose significant changes with reporting requirements by Medicaid agencies. And now, after speaking with the department, they have concerns with the level of reporting included in this rule and are cognizant of the optics with providing comments that may give the appearance they are not for transparency. However, CMS did not include adequate time to comply with these requirements, nor did they acknowledge any investments that would be needed by Medicaid agencies. The bottom line here is CMS is expecting from Medicaid agencies to receive the expenditures and sources of non-federal share associated with those payments provided by a provider type and down to the specific NPI. Now, we have our doubts whether this would even be possible, and we flagged this as an area where CMS failed to properly evaluate the impact of this proposed rule. It's part of a larger comment strategy that we'll talk about soon. Now, this slide summarizes the specific provisions of concern that we've highlighted and their proposed effective dates. Again, these are all proposed and contingent on when and if CMS finalizes this rule. But as you can see on this slide, most are listed as upon effective date of the final rule, which leads us to believe that CMS did not consult with many of their policy experts when developing this proposed rule, and because it's just not reasonable to assume this amount of change can happen without proper lead time. So we're going to spend a quick second here on what it means for California. And this slide just helps provide some context. What you see in front of you is really the total funding for the Medi-Cal program. Collectively, the Medi-Cal program is nearly $100 billion annually. And according to MACPAC, in federal fiscal year 2018, total Medicaid spending will be estimated at $616 billion across the country, which means if their estimates hold true, the Medi-Cal program represents over 16% of the national spend for Medicaid. Drilling into how Medi-Cal is actually funded, I'd like to direct your attention to the pie chart on the left. In state fiscal year 18-19, the Medi-Cal budget was in total $94 billion. The federal government in orange, the slice in orange, represents or accounts for nearly $60 billion of the total spend. Of the remaining $34 billion represented in what is representative of the non-federal share associated with the program. And then if you drill down into that, of which approximately $20 billion is funded with state general fund, so that's your section in blue, and $14 billion is funded with other non-state general fund sources, and that's your section in gray. The majority of the section in gray there is compromised of provider taxes, intergovernmental transfers, special funds, etc. And so the administration and CHA are cognizant of the optics behind sharing publicly any estimated fiscal impact and plan to remain silent on that aspect in our comment letter. But hypothetically speaking, if this rule were to be finalized, we're talking about a reduction to the other non-federal fund slice that could total in the billions, which if you, when you combine that with the loss in federal funds associated with the non-federal share, would triple the size of any reduction. So hypothetically speaking, if it were a $1 billion loss in the non-federal share associated, it would mean $3 billion in total Medicaid funding losses. $5 billion loss on non-federal share means $15 billion loss in Medicaid funding. $10 billion loss means $30 billion, right? So you get the point. There's no question the impact of this proposed rule could have devastating impacts on the Medi-Cal program and the beneficiaries you all serve in your communities today. So with that, I will pass it the call over to Alyssa to discuss our draft comments.
Thanks, Ryan, and good afternoon, everyone. As you all can see and have heard, all of those red thumbs on the pointing down on the graphics that Ryan just pointed to, that a number of these key provisions in the proposed rule are of great, great concern to CHA and to many states and actually all 49 others across the country. If implemented, the proposed rule would have significant impacts for Medicaid programs. So as we thought through our regulatory strategy in responding to the rule, as well as our next steps, we would acknowledge that CMS really does believe that the proposals will ensure fiscal sustainability and integrity in the Medicaid program. However, they completely missed the mark in achieving that goal. Rather, we see this as another path that the administration has taken to fundamentally undermine the financing of the Medicaid program, which in turn would reduce federal spending. So in light of our grave concerns and the collective magnitude of the impact, we're working very collaboratively with our national and state partners, including the American Hospital Association, and CHA's comments will be in strong opposition to the proposed rule and urge its rescission. At a high level, our comments really will highlight the main reasons why the policies outlined in the proposed rule will adversely impact the Medicaid patients you all serve every day. And at the same time, point out the numerous reasons we believe the rule is completely unworkable from a provider and state agency perspective. We're going to need your help in amplifying those messages by telling your stories, and I'll talk about that in a minute. In addition to our opposition, we don't intend to offer any alternatives for CMS consideration. We are very aware that state Medicaid agencies across the country are going to look at the proposals and try and find middle ground with CMS to mitigate some of the potential future impact. But we remain kind of stalwart in our approach that there is no workable solution, and we're asking CMS to withdraw the rule. Our strategy remains that our end goal is to really make the rule go away, but if not, our intent is to delay implementation as long as possible. As the nation's largest Medicaid program with the bluest of the blue administrations, we're very mindful of the external public-facing strategy and messaging about this rule and its impact, as Ryan alluded to, and Ann's going to also discuss that in just a moment, because I think it's important as when you look to our comments and how we have kind of positioned them. So in addition to our strong opposition and call for withdrawal, our comments are intended to provide a robust administrative record so that if we were to consider future litigation upon finalization of the rule, we would be well positioned to do so. And many hospital associations and other national associations are also taking a similar approach in ensuring that any legal arguments that we would like to make are part of the public record, as we have grave concerns about a number of the provisions and CMS's statutory authority. Our friends at Hooper, Lindy, and Bookman advise us that our strongest legal argument and one in which we've built our comments around and we think will be actually very helpful for you all in telling your story is on the impact. In our comments, we're going to point to the woefully inadequate regulatory impact analysis that seems to be the hallmark of CMS rules these days. They really are not doing their homework in proposing or in enumerating on the impact of any of these proposed changes on several aspects of the Medicaid program, and we're going to call that out in several pages. As many of you know, the Administrative Procedures Act requires CMS to conduct a complete and thorough regulatory impact analysis, and we're going to stridently argue that they have failed to meet this requirement. So as we've discussed, as if implemented, those proposed changes will undoubtedly leave states with significant holes in their state budgets, and I think the pie charts are very grounding in kind of illustrating that impact. Those holes cannot be easily filled, and the number, amount, and distribution of supplemental payments would likely decline in most states, including California, and the administration has provided no time for a transition. There's actually no significant discussions of the impacts of this reduction in payments in the proposed rule. If implemented, again, this would leave states with scarce resources, few options to fill those gaps in their budgets, and really look to cutting provider payments, limiting coverage and services, or both. As you all know, when provider reimbursement is reduced and coverage is limited, access to care for our most vulnerable patients really is in jeopardy. As you all know, California's safety net is fragile, and we will point to the fact that Medi-Cal continues to not cover costs. It's paying 78 cents on the dollar, and that a third of our state's hospitals continue to operate in the red. And so further erosion of coverage or provider reimbursement in our Medi-Cal program will negatively impact access to care. And it will have a disproportionate impact on our safety net hospitals and those rural providers located in counties with high concentration of Medicaid beneficiaries. So as you all think about the patients that you take care of in your community every day, it's really our hope that you can help articulate the important role that Medi-Cal is playing in providing access to care to your community and share those stories as part of your comments. Second, as Ryan noted, CMS believes that in many instances they're really clarifying existing policy, but as he has stated and in reading the preamble and the regulatory text, it is very clear that CMS is going beyond their existing statutory authority and proposing regulatory changes that allow for broad discretion and with no standard or clear criteria for transparent decision making. So that really creates a significant black box of uncertainty for states as they think of compliance with the proposed changes, and that gives us great concern. Third, in our comments, we will enumerate and our concern about CMS's proposals that would require states to raise additional or create new taxes on state and local communities to maintain support for the Medicaid program, and we'll be paying particular attention to those very concerning provisions and really push back on those. I think finally, again, top line, while CHA is supportive of transparency in the Medicaid program and having data to make informed policy recommendations, we too are concerned that CMS has woefully underestimated the volume of data it is asking for. And it's not just the volume. If you think about some of and have read through the proposed reporting requirements, we are very concerned that some of the reporting will confuse rather than inform the policymaking process. So not only have they underestimated kind of the volume and the resources and time and dollars that would be needed to report that, we're not sure that the intent of the data collection will really serve the policy purpose. So we will again, be calling that out. And we were actually heartened by some of the comments at MACPAC in their recent meeting, where MACPAC is, as many of you know, the nonpartisan commission that advises Congress and the Secretary on Medicaid policy. They noted that this rule could have been two separate rules. The first, to collect data to inform policy work, and then a subsequent rule that would have used that data to support the proposed changes. I think we will see numerous comments go into the administration regarding these and other concerns. And then also we will politely remind CMS of their rationale for rescinding the Medicaid access rule. Many of you all may remember we were in full support of a rule that would have really required states to fully assess access to care for Medi-Cal beneficiaries and had significant reporting requirements that we thought would be beneficial for oversight of the program. CMS used the regulatory burden argument to rescind that rule, yet is kind of doing an about-face in this proposed rule in making additional requirements that have similar burdensome requirements on states. So as we mentioned, so those are top line of our comments, and they're roughly at about 20 pages at the moment, and they're continued to be refined, and we're looking forward to your comments today and your thoughts to share with us as we continue to refine those comments and make them available to you. As we continue to mention, this is a proposed rule. There is no timeline for finalization of it. Therefore, we're going to leave no stone unturned in our efforts to derail its implementation. And that's where many of you working with your health system government relations liaisons, as well as your internal teams, we're hoping that you all will join us in responding to this proposed rule. We will be making available to you a template letter for your use. It is our hope that we would have it in the CHA January 17th edition that may slip to the following week as, we're working to collaboratively align our asks and our arguments with our national and state partners. It's really critical that we have a significant volume and variation of the letters, and that's where, as I mentioned, you telling your story of the role that Medi-Cal plays in affording access to our most vulnerable populations and allowing you to care for those patients. The access argument is critical here, and one that I think you all are well positioned to articulate and then have that supported by some additional policy bullet points that we're happy to provide to you for your consideration and inclusion. Again, we're encouraging everyone to submit comments in coordination with their health systems. By January 31st, it was rather odd that CMS finalized a Saturday deadline, but think it is prudent for folks to get it in by Friday the 31st at 2 p.m. So that really concludes our regulatory strategy. I'm going to turn it over to Anne to enumerate on some other steps we're taking. Anne?
Thank you, Alyssa, and thank you, Ryan, for that deep dive on this complex issue. Whenever the issues are this complex, we, of course, have a multi-pronged approach. Obviously, the detailed regulatory and legal approach that Alyssa has outlined will be first and foremost, and as she said, encourage your participation in that regulatory approach. We are also working with our national associations, particularly at AHA, to encourage our colleagues from red states with Republican governors to reach out to CMS and to the administration in strong opposition to the impact that this will have on their state budgets. This has been a strategy that we have successfully employed in the past. Ryan outlined a number of times when we have had to fight back challenging Medicaid regulations. And we are hopeful that those governors will continue that outreach. And Carmela and will be in Washington next week at an AHA meeting where we hope to learn more about that strategy. So first and foremost, having a red state strategy to gather attention to the impact this would have on Medicaid beneficiaries is really critical. Obviously, the state of California, being deep blue and as big as we are, and as controversial as California has become for this administration, it's clearly not an effective thing for California to be the leading face on a political strategy. So working with our colleagues at the national level on that approach, we are also working to educate the California congressional delegation about the impact that this will have, and will develop a congressional strategy when and if it's appropriate after we learn more about the red state gubernatorial strategy. Again, it does not seem prudent to have a California-facing say a California delegation letter. We really don't want to attract attention to the size of our Medicaid program. It could definitely have an adverse effect, but we'll be working on a national strategy as well, talking with our colleagues to see if there's potential to do a bipartisan letter from Congress. Those are the kinds of steps that are going to need to be informed as we go through this process. It's notable that Congress can comment and or intervene or let their feelings be known well after the comment period. Congress is not limited, as we are, to submit comments by February 1st. So a political rather than regulatory strategy is going to be something that is ongoing and evolving as more information becomes available. So know that we are pursuing a lot of different ideas and different strategies, gathering some more information, making sure our delegation is well educated, and when it's appropriate to encourage your engagement in those strategies, you'll be hearing more from us as this issue evolves. So that is where we are in terms of an advocacy rather than regulatory strategy. Let me now turn it back to Alyssa so we can begin the question period to hear more from you.
Great. Thanks so much, Anne. As a reminder, before we turn to questions, the comment deadline, again, is January 31st, that we are recommending that folks get their comments in. Many of you are part of larger health systems that will be coordinating those comments to ensure that you have a system of voice that is being shared with CMS. We encourage you to collaborate with your system GR liaisons in sharing your perspectives and ensuring that your comments are reflected. And lastly, before we turn it over to questions, want to remind folks that both our regulatory strategy as well as some of the broader strategy that we have just discussed is being coordinated nationally. So we do have a question in the queue that said, will other state hospital associations be also calling for a rescission? Yes, it is our understanding that currently that is a wide-held provider strategy, one in which we would like to convince others is also a viable strategy. So many state hospital associations, including CHA, are working with other provider groups within the state to coalesce around a set of comments that we believe would be of great importance in sharing with the administration. So I will pause there and open it up to the operator first to see, operator, if you can share again instructions for how best to get on the line to ask a question, and then we will go to the online questions.
To ask a question, you may press star, then 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then 2. At this time, we will pause momentarily to assemble our roster. Our first question comes from Shelley Schlenker with Dignity Health, Common Spirit Health. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for a phenomenal briefing. We are indeed doing system comments and will coordinate with our folks. One question I have reached out to AHA on is whether they want fiscal impact numbers in any of the red states. For instance, we've been looking at what's going on in Arizona and have had some dialogue with Governor Ducey. So, Carmela, as you head to your meeting, I think some level of guidance fairly quickly about what they want relative to fiscal impact or not in red state letters would be exceedingly helpful.
Thanks, Shelley. That's a really important question that we will ask and certainly get back to you. I don't know, Anne or Carmela, if you have any additional thoughts, but we can certainly take that back and encourage AHA to also articulate that when they put out their model comment letter to advise states as to where they believe it would be most beneficial for that fiscal impact to be enumerated, if that makes sense.
And Alyssa, it's Carmela. The only thing I might add, Shelley, thank you so much for the question. AHA is coordinating fiscal impact work on behalf of all states. What we know is the case is some states have better data than other states. And we hope to find out next week when we're in D.C. how that's falling. In California, we happen to be very fortunate that we've got some pretty solid good numbers. In other states, it's a little darker. Thanks. Will do.
Operator, additional questions on the phone line?
Our next question comes from Bob Holinsky with Universal Health Services. Please go ahead.
Great. Good afternoon. Thank you. Great presentation. Excellent job. Question about, I think, you know, the one aspect, if I got this correct, the comment letter was going to remain silent regarding sort of the CHFT and sort of that whole aspect of sort of private mitigation sort of outside the formal program. And to remain silent, I was a little confused by that, but maybe you can explain a little bit, because if we have to go litigate later on, if you don't raise objections in the comment letter, then how, you know, aren't the courts going to basically say, hey, you didn't raise objection in the comment letter? So can you just explain a little bit about that, the strategy to remain silent, and maybe I misinterpreted it too.
Sure, Alyssa, I'll take first crack at that. So this is Ryan. Our strategy, specifically with that provision in the proposed rule, is definitely, as you said, to remain silent. When we read the preamble, it's pretty clear on the intent, but when we have dug in a little bit deeper, the actual regulatory text doesn't. It isn't matching the intent of the preamble, and so it's really two things. One, there's sensitivity about alerting CMS that there is an arrangement, right, in California. We're not 100% sure that they do know that. And then the second item is whether or not we pose questions that then further clarify the final regulatory text if this rule were to become final. And so we're looking at the actual legal bandwidth that we have here, if we can continue the program or what it may look like, but it's a really good question, and that's kind of where we stand. I'm not sure if Lloyd or Paul from Hooper Lenny Bookman want to expand on that.
This is Lloyd. I think Ryan said it correctly, Bob, but as we read the text of the proposed reg, we think it would not adversely impact the CHFT program because it appears to only preclude programs where the state is the actor in leveling out the impact of a fee program. And here in our situation, it's in California's situation, that's not the case. And so we think, in our view, is that as the regulatory text sits today, we're in pretty good shape. Notwithstanding some of the more troubling language in the preamble, and we don't want the regulatory language to get tightened up in a way that would be adverse. If we ever have to litigate and they change the regulatory language from what is currently there, then we would, I think, be pretty free to say what we want to say at that point, because then they would have changed the reg.
Thank you.
Great. Let's take a couple of questions that are in the queue. We'll start off with a question. Maybe Ryan start off, but Lloyd maybe chime in. How does the proposed rule intersect with California's Proposition 52, if at all? Does the proposed rule nullify all or parts of Prop 52? Or does Prop 52 provide California hospitals with any protection? Do folks have thoughts on that question?
Sure. I'll start, and Lloyd, feel free to chime in. The language within Proposition 52 kind of codified the existing structure. It just kind of continued the statutory provisions that authorize the state to administer the hospital fee program. And included in that text, in that legal framework, was that provision that gave the department discretion to make necessary changes to meet federal requirements. And so, that discretionary ability for the state to make changes, we do feel would continue to operate the hospital fee program. However, they would have to conform and make changes to meet the new federal requirements.
And the only thing I would add is to the question as to whether the protections that are in Prop 52 for hospitals still apply. They do. In particular, requirements that all of the funding except the specified limited amount go back, be used to support hospitals. And the limitation of the amount that goes back to the state for children's services that doesn't run back through the Medi-Cal program, that limitation remains in place. So I think the key protections of Prop 52 remain in place. But as Ryan said, there may, within as permitted by Prop 52, the program may have to be modified to comply with this proposed rule if it's adopted.
Thanks, Lloyd. Operator, are there any additional questions on the phone line?
There are no further questions at this time.
We have two final questions in the queue. If we could quickly take them. The first is, will hospitals be getting an estimate of the impact on each hospital to understand more? Carmela or Ryan, did you want to take that question?
Sure, I can jump in. So it's just to be completely transparent, if the proposed rule were finalized, we can identify what the changes would be to the hospital fee program, assuming that it continues making changes to the taxing rates and ensuring that the compliance of that would continue. However, what we do not have would be what the impact to the broader Medicaid program would be and what that means to reduction in services, to reduction in populations, what it would be. If the state is facing a gap of tens of billions of dollars, what would the state do to make changes to live within their overall budget? And that is an area that we do not have the ability to quantify at this point. So we will not be providing any specific hospital estimates or anything to that extent. If you have specific questions as to what changes would need to be made to the hospital fee structure, you could please feel free to reach out and I can help share that intel. But it wouldn't necessarily include any external changes that would happen either by the legislature or the administration.
And I think one of the things that we're trying to emphasize in our comments broadly is that this has significant impacts for state budgets, as Ryan mentioned, and we notably kind of point out the dollars at risk on the pie charts. And so I think any the fact that so much of those dollars are at risk and the choices that states would have to make to fill those gaps is really analogous to kind of the repeal and the replace arguments that we've had over the past several years, where we really want to talk broadly about the important role that Medi-Cal plays and that the erosion of coverage and subsequent reduction in provider payments and what that would do to services in your community. So while we might not necessarily want to or need to quantify specifically that for your institution, I think we can point to the large gap and the unintended consequences that gap would provide. I am cognizant of the fact that we are 2 minutes past the top of the hour. Have some additional questions that are in the queue. We will respond to those offline. We want to be mindful and respectful of your time. Want to ask Carmela if you had any additional concluding comments before we adjourn.
Thank you so much, Alyssa. Not other than to say thank you for taking a good solid hunk of your time. We hope this has been helpful. You can see that we are staffed up on this one. Please do continue to keep us informed in terms of what you're hearing, not only within the state of California, but with relationships you may have outside of the state of California. As has been mentioned, we've got a very important meeting next week in D.C. with all 50 state hospital associations and the American Hospital Association. We will have more to report back to you at that point as we continue to move through our advocacy strategy. I want to thank our team, the team at Hooper Lundy Bookman, for all of their hard work on this, and we want to thank you for your continued support. I just want to underscore it, please. Comments, volume, and variation, and just a reminder, if they look like cookie-cutter letters, CMS throws them out. So would ask you to please take the time to tailor those letters. We appreciate, as always, your support to beat back a really bad proposed reg. Thanks.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.